Can the police collect and use your cell phone records without a warrant? That was the question at the heart of Carpenter versus the United States.
Carpenter was under investigation for participating in a series of armed robberies, and the police were able to use his cell phone records to put him in the vicinity of the robberies, and he was ultimately convicted.
That's Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, who explained the basics of the case on The Takeaway last fall. Timothy Carpenter was convicted in part after police collected nearly 13,000 separate points of cell phone data location over the course of 4 months without a warrant. And on Friday, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court determined that the government needs a warrant to access a person's cell phone location history. Such a search falls under the Fourth Amendment. So, a big win for digital privacy, but the case raises much bigger questions about the state of police surveillance. And all this week, we'll be exploring the types of technology that police are using, how they're using it, and to what consequence. And we begin with Barry Friedman, professor at New York University School of Law and the director of the Policing Project.
I think it happened along with the rise of the digital age and data, just like one would expect, but the nature of policing has changed completely. It used to be that policing was like you watch mostly on television. The police knew a crime had happened, or they expected one to happen, and they had a suspect, and they went after that individual. But eventually we realized that with all of this digital technology, we could keep everybody under watch and thereby avoid bad things from happening altogether. So the example that I give, which isn't fully digital but partly relies on technology, is airport security. We don't have all that expensive security so that we catch the gun or the bomb, though we hope to, is to keep all of us from bringing one. And the same thing is true of CCTV cameras that hang over our heads and bulk data collection by the NSA. The idea is to keep everybody under surveillance all the time, then look for something that's problematic.
So some people would say, but Barry, I mean, come on, we're in an era where we all have cell phones. We all understand that there's a certain amount of data that we're leaving, little breadcrumbs of data that we're leaving out there. And, you know, this is just sort of part of what our reality is today, right? What makes this so scary?
Yeah, well, you know, breadcrumbs is an interesting thing to mention. It makes me think of Goldilocks. So, you know, when you leave this data out there, it's easy for the government to come find you at any moment. And people often say, well, you know, but I haven't done anything wrong. Well, why do I care? But I ask people to think about what their privacy means, not from companies that want to sell them things or from friends that they're willingly giving information to, but from the government that has this unique power to keep them under surveillance, to check on them, take them away in the middle of the night. And, you know, if you want to get a real feel for what it means, and I often say this to groups when I speak to them, send me your email address and your password. And let me read your emails for the last month or two. I'm sure there are plenty of things in there that even though you don't have anything to hide, you haven't committed any crime, you just don't want the world knowing. And it's that sense of being an individual, of privacy, of things that embarrass us a little bit, that we're trying to keep to ourselves. And the last people that we want to have all that information is the government.
So I actually, about 2 years ago, went out to Camden, New Jersey, and took a ride along with the police department there. And they were very happy to show us their technology that they were using to both pinpoint something called ShotSpotter, which they used to pinpoint where or at least they said where gunshots happened. They were using license plate reader technology that as we drove in the car, they were sort of picking up different people's license plates and scanning those. What are the concerns about this type of technology?
So I'm going to come at your question inside out, if you don't mind. I mean, we at the Policing Project that I run at NYU Law School, we work very closely with the Camden Police, and the chief there, Scott Thompson, is terrific. He's just who I want to be a police officer. And I'd be the first to concede that the technology has great promise. You know, there are some people that say all in on technology and some people that are say absolutely no to policing technology. And I think that's the wrong question. The question is, how can we use these technologies responsibly in ways that help us fight crime and violence, but also avoid the downsides that you can have? So one of them, for example, is license plate readers, which you mentioned. They scoop up the license plates of everyone near them. And originally, they were acquired on the theory that would help get stolen cars. But not as many cars get stolen today, and license plate readers are kind of a random way to do that. It turns out they're really good, though, at finding out who's got a warrant. And maybe they've just got a warrant because they haven't paid a couple of traffic tickets. And where do license plate readers live? They live tend to live in marginalized neighborhoods and minority neighborhoods where the police are. And so even something as simple as a license plate reader can have huge discriminatory bias to it and be used to kind of perpetuate an over-policing of African-American communities. That's just one of the many problems. Another one is location tracking. So somebody out in California just filed a Freedom of Information request for, you know, if the police had any information about him, and they had this list of license plate reads on him, including him getting into his car with his daughter somewhere, sort of everywhere he'd been over a period. And that's kind of crazy. Like, why should the government have that information?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Barry Friedman, a professor at New York University School of Law, and we're talking about policing in the 21st century. Let's talk a little bit about the effectiveness of some of these policing technologies. I remember calling and talking to a bunch of police departments around the country about how effective they thought some of these tools they had were, and there were mixed reactions from different police departments. Some thought, you know, we're really not seeing an impact. It's not really telling us more than what we already know. Others said it, you know, was still too early to tell. Are you hearing that these are effective on the law enforcement side?
I'm so glad you asked that question. One of the things we focus on at the Policing Project is cost-benefit analysis of policing, which sounds like a big snore, but it actually asks some important questions. You know, what are you spending on this technology? How well is it working? Are there bad things happening that we should be avoiding? And when you start to do that, for some of the technologies, you really need to worry. They can be very expensive. They may not be more effective than other alternatives that are cheaper or more familiar. And you may be picking up lots of folks that don't deserve to be picked up, which is, you know, flooding your police station with people that you're picking up or arresting that turn out to not have anything that they've done wrong. And so you got to be very thoughtful about these technologies and say, is it really an advance? We're doing almost no testing of that sort of thing.
And what about this notion that when we begin to collect data and start to, the way I like to describe it, is start to connect the pipes, right, with, let's say, these quote-unquote gang databases being connected with FBI databases, being connected with facial recognition technology, at what point do people or citizens essentially start to lose their right to not just be forgotten, but if you've already been involved in a crime and now you're in a database, is there any way, is this a permanent stain, I guess, is the question? Can you ever get away from this?
It's difficult. We talk about minimization. We talk about cleaning databases. We talked about that with the NSA data collection. But you have to chuckle, right? You know how many of these breadcrumbs there are, and the chance of cleaning them all up off the floor is, you know, pretty minimal. What I suggest and what the Policing Project cares a lot about, and I talk a great deal about in my book Unwarranted, is needing to get on top of this by regulating it on the front end. So what we need to do is have transparency about how the pipes are being assembled, and then we ought to have approval by the people of doing so. What's happened is over time, we've just gotten in the habit of letting law enforcement do whatever it wants, and for good reasons. We all want to be safe. Everybody wants to be safe, and we have a lot of respect for the folks that work to make us safe. But at the same time, they're mission driven and they're very mission focused, and they're not always thinking about all these other things. And so what we need to do is surface exactly what law enforcement's doing, particularly around these new technologies, and then get a public yes or no on exactly how they're operating.
And this is a topic we're going to be exploring all this week on The Takeaway, Policing and Technology. Barry Friedman is a professor at New York University School of Law and director of the Policing Project. He's also the author of Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.